Today is Thursday, April 4th, 2013. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing Distinguished Professor Jim Pochin, Chairman of the Radiology Department at Michigan State University, and so much more. You received your bachelor's degree from MSU in 1954, your degree in medicine from Wayne State, a master's degree in management from MIT, and a law degree from the University of Michigan. You have roamed all over the academic world. I'd like to start our conversation with some details about your childhood, things like where you were born, where you grew up, your siblings and parents.
I was born in, thank you, Pauline, but it's an honor to be interviewed by you. I've known you a long time, too. But it's a pleasure to be able to do this. I was born in Flushing, New York. Walter and I used to talk about that.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, but I left at age 3 months. I don't remember it very well. My father at that time, that was in the Depression. And my father at that time was working for the Haskellite Company, and he was doing wood fabrication engineering. And what he was working on was the Rockefeller Center wood things. You see in the back of the Rockefeller Center? All those plywood. Plywood was had just been invented, essentially.
Oh, I didn't.
And the different glues and things. And he was an engineer. He graduated from Northwestern University, Phi Beta Kappa. He had come over here from Europe at the end of the First War.
Oh.
And he didn't speak English, essentially, and started right off at Northwestern University.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing what those people could do in those days. But they still do that. Some people are very talented. As I said, he was Phi Beta Kappa, and which was very, for him and the family, that was a big thing. Anyway, he was building the, working to build the Rockefeller Center, among other things they did in wood engineering and wood fabrication. And he spent his life essentially doing that, working for the Haskellite Company. And then when he was older, in his 50s or late 50s, he left that and went to started to teach. And he taught at Aquinas College, and he taught physics. And that was his love. And when I was a child, physics, quantum mechanics was a big thing for him. In fact, he worked on quantum mechanic equations in 1928 at the time of the Solvay Conference. The Solvay Conference was when people agreed that we've learned what nature is like. Now let's spend some time and try to figure out what life is like. And what is life was the next thing after knowing the nature of nature. What is the nature of life? And that's where the first idea that life is a code came up. One of the earlier ideas. And the idea of it being a code, and then they finally led to the DNA code. But my father was into all that stuff. And he was a consummate European polymath. In any subject you'd like to name, history, he had books on a lot of great books on history, and he would read all kinds of history all the time. Pauline, the thing that was really fun, and I've done that with my children, and my grandchildren are getting the same thing. Around the dinner table in the evening, he would ask, I had two brothers, and my father would say, what did you learn today? People do that, and they pass it off rather lightly. But we took it serious. And someone would say they've learned something, and then the family would agree that's something we're going to look up today. And we would go to the encyclopedia and look it up as a family. And we would read the section in the encyclopedia. After many years, we got through good portions of the encyclopedia.
It's amazing.
It was just wonderful. And we would all try to recall what we learned last week. And, you know, as the students, my mother taught English. She went to Western Michigan. At the time was Western Normal.
Mm-hmm.
And she went there and then she became the principal of Ada High School.
Oh.
She taught fourth grade for some 50 years.
Wow.
But they moved her to the... You know, Ada was a very small town at the time. Now they've got a very big company there, Amway.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but anyway, my parents, my mother's families are from Michigan, and they settled in Grand Rapids area in 1840s.
Oh, early.
Early, yeah. In fact, my grandfather used to canoe with the Indians on the Grand River.
Wouldn't it be delightful?
Isn't that something?
Yes, if we could still do that.
Yeah. Well, it's a wonderful history back there. And
it sounds as if your childhood may helped mold you into what you ended up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nothing was unimportant enough that it shouldn't be studied.
That's wonderful.
And my father and mother both were consummate scholars.
So tell us a little about your college education. For instance, why did you choose Michigan State in 1954?
In the
early 50s, you graduated in 54.
In 1950, I chose Michigan State because I had read a book in high school. This was at the end of the big war and things, and people were uncertain to what the future held. We had a depression. We've had a tremendous problem with what the value of the future, if anything, was going to be in the future. And one thing my uncle had told me, and he came from Germany, and he said the one thing that will be always valued is education. Get all of it you can and put that away as human capital. And I read a book called 5 Acres in Independence by Kane. And I use it actually in some of my classes yet. It's still around. You can still get it. And how can you live on 5 acres? And I had the vision that I could live with 5 acres of land and grow all my food and take care of my family and earn enough money to do whatever I needed money for. But I wanted to be self-sustaining. And now self-sustaining agriculture is a big thing. But in those days, I envisioned a future where I would be able to take care of myself no matter what happened to the world. And, you know, you didn't know at the end of the war what was going to happen to the world. So
it's a good objective today, too, because we don't know what's going to happen to the world.
At the best, the future is uncertain. And if you can develop a capacity within yourself to take care of yourself and those around you, then you would be much better off. And I had felt that just naturally. I mean, it's common sense, in my opinion. So I was so excited about the chance to learn everything and anything, and I figured I'd have to learn something about agriculture. And my father had bought 5 acres of land, 7 acres actually, and so and we built a little greenhouse on it. And when I was in high school, I grew flowers in the greenhouse, and we made corsages for all the other people, for all the dances and things. And I said, I think I'll be a florist. From there, I can go into anything to grow things. It'd be a good thing to know how to do. So I enjoyed that immensely. And Michigan State was the best place to learn that at the time.
And that's what led you
and
here.
And that's what I started out in horticulture.
Mm-hmm.
The first class I had was with Anthony in agriculture. He was dean of the School of Agriculture and Ag 101. And I took soil science. It was really quite funny. I got to learn to be able to feel different loams and tell which loam was which loam and things. It was wonderful. And that got me in a little bit to geology. But you can get to anything you want from any place. And this is how I got into life sciences, eventually.
I see. When you graduated, was your degree in
I was in horticulture while I was here, and I changed it to zoology because when I was here, the Korean War was on.
Right.
And all my classmates from high school had to go off to Korea.
Right.
And they were reporting back to me about frozen feet and things. It was not good. And I said, I don't think that's what I'd like to do if I could avoid it. And the way you could avoid it, they said that anyone who wants to stay in college has to take this one test, January 19th of 1951. whole nation from Princeton Testing Service would take this deferment test to be allow them to stay in college and not go to the military. Well, I'm not just a coward. I'm not a dumb coward. So I said, I decided that I would try to take, everybody took the test. And they were able to give me a deferment, which I thought was very nice. And I got deferred from the military at that time. But then subsequent years, I kept getting inquiries about where I'm going to serve in the military and what I'm going to do. I was in the ROTC, in the Air Force, and I advanced up to those ladders. And then I decided to go to medical school because that was the surest way of getting a deferment. Now, that wasn't the only reason I decided to go to medical school.
I'm sure.
When I was 5 years old, my family thought I was going to be the family doctor.
They needed one.
And yeah, that's right. And so they had me convinced that medicine wouldn't be so bad very early on. And when I got to college, I found it wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be. You know, we had the basic sciences then. Remember that?
I certainly
did. The basic
do.
College. And in the basic college, you could take these cop-out tests, and you can get 3 years of full credit for at the end of one semester, you know, and you take the comps, we called them.
One quarter. There
one
were
quarter.
No semesters.
No, that's right. There were quarter. Three quarters.
That's right.
But you could take all of the things if you did really well and at the end of the first. Well, I went in them and I really enjoyed it. They were multiple choice questions and I just really enjoyed that. I remember the history of civilization at that time from what I learned around a dining room table. I got 100% in the midterm.
Amazing.
On ancient history.
Yeah.
And that really astounded the history department,
I
who thought I should
it.
Be a historian. And so they treated me very nice. And I did a lot of different things like that. Biological sciences. I read up on biological sciences. I just read it from my textbooks when I was in high school. And I did very well on that. And so I did well enough on the basic sciences to finish the basic college in very short order.
Clearly.
In 4 or 5 terms.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, 6 terms, all those classes, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
And also the
one. You remember
one,
them.
Yes, well, I was here, but I didn't start teaching in the basic college until 1956.
Yeah.
And
well,
I was
just finishing it then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Written and spoken English was one we had.
That's what I started teaching.
Spitting in broken English.
That's right. We did too. Because that's what it was with those students.
Yeah.
And then it was changed to communication skills,
yes.
The name. And then it was changed to American thought and language.
Yeah.
And now it's writing, rhetoric, and American culture. So oh. You see, I've been here long enough to have taught in a department with 4 different names.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you obviously enjoyed the academic setting, given all the graduate work you undertook and the variety of fields you explored. Tell us about the various graduate degree programs that you conquered.
I didn't conquer any of them, but I enjoyed them all. I've had you never conquer it. Any academic pursuit completely. There's so much more to learn in every subject you think you know anything about. And I am thrilled with the realization of the uncertainty of everything I know.
So what led you, for instance, to take a degree in management?
I was at Washington University at the time, and I was professor of radiology. And I wanted to have some mark behind my name that would make me sufficiently different that I would be more likely to become chief. And among those things that you could have, I mean, nobody had gone into management at the time, but I had a chance to get a Sloan Fellowship at MIT. And that was the number one pinnacle of academic pursuit at the time. Economics at MIT was as good as there was around, and a lot of good things about MIT. And I had friends at MIT. I took my residency in Boston.
Oh, you did?
At the Peter Ben Brigham Hospital at Harvard.
Yes.
And I'd spent some time with the leaders of radiology at the time. In fact, it was, I took my internship at Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids. I went out and practiced, and I was a general practitioner, making house calls every day. I'd make up to 5 house calls a night.
That sounds like ancient history.
That is ancient history, but Jerry remembers we used to wake up at night, and the phone would ring all night long. I'd get up to 20 phone calls between midnight and 6, and I delivered babies. I delivered in the hundreds of babies at the time. I mean, every night I'd be out in the delivery or something, and she'd be home. We had 3 kids by that time, and I finally got, I went to a reunion of my class, and I said, maybe there's more to life than just being a general practitioner. And my classmates had all gone into residencies, and I just stayed in general practice. I took what I learned in medical school, went out and applied it after a year of internship. And then I decided that, Jerry and I decided together, that we would go off and do a residency, and I applied to the Brigham, and I got admitted immediately. And that was considered really, I never thought I'd ever get to there from Michigan State. You know, it was the pinnacle. And so I was delighted, and I went there, and I had a wonderful time. I excelled in many things they had for us. I did a little research project early on strange amino acids. I had an idea that if we could label a protein synthesis, which is I was going to study the synthesis of protein, hopefully someday in human beings, but I had been studied it first in the rat parathyroid gland, because I wanted to label the parathyroid gland, and I used tritium first, which was a very short isotope. I did it with beta isotopes and did it with autoradiography. And the first article I wrote was autoradiography of the rat parathyroid.
Has much progress been made in the field of parathyroidism?
Yes, it has, but not as much as I'd hoped at the time. But what came out of that was called now nuclear medicine, using radioactive tracers to identify the physiology of the body. And I became very active in quantified physiology and the very interested in the kinetics of body function. Mm-hmm. And so we began to study that from many ways. And protein synthesis in the body was a big thing to study, and I studied that, and then I got it, and I wrote some articles for the Journal of Biological Chemistry. You know, and I wrote them for a lot of articles on that stuff. But nuclear medicine became the field, and I was into nuclear medicine when it started. And I was the first chief of nuclear medicine at Harvard.
Oh, that's impressive.
Well, it's a long time ago.
Well, it's just as impressive.
But I worked up that ladder
today.
Pretty rapidly, too.
Yes, yes.
Because there wasn't much
competition. So how long did you live in the Boston area?
At that time, 6 years? At that time, 6 years.
Oh, that's a long time.
We went back there for a Sloan Fellowship many years later, and we lived there for another year, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
6 years, you were 4 years of residency, 3 years, right, and then you stayed on the staff.
Yeah, I stayed on the staff at the Brigham.
Mm-hmm.
They put me on the staff, and I stayed on there for 4 years of residency and then a staff position.
And then what led you to take a degree in law at the University of Michigan?
Well, I went from Harvard to Washington University in St. Louis, where I was the chief of, I started off as chief of nuclear medicine, and then I became chief of diagnostic imaging, radiology, at the Mallinckrodt Institute of Radiology, which was the largest radiology department in the nation. And then I...
Well, that's when you went to the Sloan School after that.
Yeah, then I went to Sloan School.
You went to that. You were here when you went to the law school.
Yes, you went to law school while you were at Michigan State.
Right.
So I know I'm
Cecil
taking...
Cecil Mackey gave me permission to go. I remember that very well.
Well, and as a lawyer, he wanted to welcome you into the profession.
Right.
But what in you made you want to go there?
I was chairing at that time the Committee on Accreditation of Medical Schools. And we were trying to close a weak medical school. And I was being sued as the chairman. And that made me furious. And I said, lawyers have got to be all crooks. Why would they do this to us? And I had very little confidence in law and lawyers, because why would they do that? We were trying to do the right thing. The committee was made of pretty prestigious people. And we were included on that committee was Sandra O'Connor.
Oh, really?
She was the public member from Arizona. And it was a small committee, but Sandra was the public member. And Sandra, I would go to the meetings and I would complain ferociously about how crooked lawyers had to be suing us. And I would be mad. And she would tell me, you got to cool down, Jim. Lawyers aren't all evil. And she finally convinced me of that. And I went to law school. She wrote the letter to get me into law school.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and she was very nice to me. I mean, she still is. I've known her for some time now. I was with her the day she met Reagan.
Oh, you were.
She said, Jim, I've got to cut out of the meeting this morning. I said, we don't have time for you to go visit the White House. She said, I'm going to go see the president. I said, you are? And she said, yes. And then she did. And it was in the newspaper the next day. And she said, she came in the next day, she said, I got to get out of town because I don't even know what I think about abortions. And she was the first woman to go to be on the Supreme Court.
On the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Yes, and she has a new memoir out right now and is getting a lot of publicity for
it. I didn't see it. I didn't see it.
Yes, a lot of interviews on radio and television.
I haven't seen them.
About that memoir, yes.
She's a really nice lady, very bright lady.
That's what I understand, yes.
She was a classmate of the Supreme Court Chief Justice at the time.
I didn't realize that. Was it Warren?
No, R. Starts at R.
Oh.
He's on the board now?
No.
Well, I don't.
No, I don't know who he was.
I can't.
But she was, when she got appointed, Reagan appointed her.
Right.
And we had a big, big discussion that night. We ate at a Viennese restaurant.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So did you have Viennese?
Wiener Schnitzel.
Oh, you had Wiener Schnitzel, of course. And you had a torta for dessert.
Yeah.
Sounds
Dover's
good.
Torta.
Yes, that's it. Sounds great. So I would like to hear about what led you to return to Michigan State as a faculty member.
At that time I was I'd come up to MIT and got my degree.
Right.
And I was offered the job as Dean for Management and Resources at Johns Hopkins Medical School.
I see.
And I went down there and I was working there. And then I wrote a thesis on management of medical schools when I was at MIT. And I'd studied Hopkins. That's how I got in that job at Hopkins.
You were there for 2 years.
For 2 years, and I decided to go to Michigan State after they came to see me and offered me, they wanted me to consult about the new Department of Radiology. And they didn't have an x-ray machine, and they didn't have a hospital. And when I came out here to look at it, they didn't have any money. And I met with Cliff Wharton, and he was really nice. And he said, they really want a medical school, but they're not going to have a medical school if they can't have an x-ray machine. A radiology department of any type. So my agreement at the time was that I will try to build them a radiology department. And I figured I knew how to build because I learned about management and building things at MIT.
Right.
And I figure I could do that, but they'd have to leave me alone. They didn't do that, though.
They didn't leave you alone?
No, they didn't really leave me alone.
In what ways did they not leave you alone?
They began to layer other things onto what I was doing. And they gave me more things to do, different departments and divisions that got in trouble. One of the things I became an expert at was picking up diseased units. That was much later, my wife tells me.
Okay.
And that was after you got the new building, before you were in there.
Yeah.
They did leave you alone.
They left me alone for a long enough time to build what I had to build.
Initially, yeah.
Yes.
Now, what would you say were your the high points in your life, professional life, at Michigan State?
The people here are worth really serving. That's what I find the thing. The people. There were many people who did not have all the opportunities that I had and hadn't realized them. And they were outstanding human beings who deserved a chance to do better. And so I became very much involved in seeing what I could do to improve the situation for the average faculty here. And it was, to me, a really worthwhile venture to spend my life seeing how I could improve the situation of academia in an institution like Michigan State, because it can be just as academic as Harvard or Hopkins or MIT, but it didn't have the self-image. And their problem was appreciation of themselves. And I had always had plenty of that, self-confidence.
And you try to spread it around.
I try to spread it around, that's correct.
So that would have been a high point for you to try to achieve that.
Yes.
Here at Michigan State.
Yes.
And can you think of any specific event that stands out in your mind as something really great that you experienced in your
sitting
years?
Sitting on committees with Walter was one of the highlights of being here. Seriously. I can recall a morning... Roger Wilkinson was chairing this committee. The president would have these committees for vice presidents to search committees. And Walter and I used to serve on some of those committees.
That was before he was president. Or after?
After he was president.
After he was president.
Yeah, long after he was president.
Okay.
And I would be, Walter was really the distinguished faculty here at Michigan State. He was the pinnacle of the faculty, as far as I was concerned. Well, he just was. And he and I sat on this committee, and he used to smoke the cigar. I never forget that. And we were having a meeting over at Kellogg Center, and he had to have a cigar, so he stepped out in the hallway, and the fire trucks came because the smoke of his cigar turned on a fire alarm. And Roger was really nervous. Roger Wilkinson was the vice president in charge of finances for the university at the time.
You know, Roger was Walter's student.
Yes. Everybody was Walter's student.
It seems that way.
Anyone who knew Walter was his student very quickly.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He never told me that.
Getting the MR machine here was a big thing.
Oh, the big thing was getting, they didn't have any equipment. So I had friends I made up in industry. I became very big with friends in big companies, General Electric, Siemens, Philips were the three major companies in radiology, and I got to know them very well, and I got especially close to the General Electric company, and I would travel around the world. That we would develop products, and we would sell them for them. I mean, you know, create an awareness of what difference they could make. And I gave lectures all over the world. Atoms in Action. That's one of the big things we did. I was had worked for the Atomic Energy Commission. And there's a lot of things. But one of the things we did was we've agreed with other countries that if they wouldn't build the bomb, we would teach them peaceful uses of the bomb. Of the atom. Peaceful uses of what the bomb
could
do. The useful, and nuclear medicine was what it became called. And I traveled and gave these, we put swimming pool reactor. We did it in South Korea, Seoul, Korea. We did it in a lot of different countries, Romania. Many countries we would go to and set up swimming pool reactors. and teach peaceful uses of the atom. And
That must have been a real high point in your life and your career.
Well, it was. It was very exciting, and it still is. I met a lot of good people from that. And I worked for the State Department then, and that was a very good... And I'd get all their briefings on these countries, and I'd really spend my time studying up on them. I learned a great deal about Korean culture, for example.
I bet.
And it's wonderful.
Yes.
Our government knows a lot of stuff.
I'm sure. And you've cultivated a taste for the Korean cuisine.
Right. I have. I've cultivated, look at the size of me. I've cultivated a taste for cuisine from all over the world. And I have tried, I've been to every country of the world, I think, everyone that I can think of. And on the map, I've missed a couple of places in Central Asia. Kazakhstan I've not been to yet.
Oh. Well, you never know.
You just never know.
You never know.
What? Oh, I was, yeah, one of the things that was exciting is I was, one of my students was a professor at University of Alexandria.
Oh, yes.
And he invited me to there, and I had been working in Turkey at Ankara for our government, setting up a reactor, which we did, and I was invited to go down and visit Alexandria, Egypt, University of Alexandria. And so I left at the time of the Six-Day War. I left Turkey and went to Alexandria, and I was there when the war started.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, that was not good.
No.
I didn't like that so well.
Tell me what the professor said before the war started.
The professor, at this university, I was there talking to them because I was trying to find out what I could for our government. And, you know, I'm kind of a naive. I'm not a spy, but I'm no good at that either. But I'm too outspoken. But I was sitting there talking to this professor, and he said, we've got 700,000 troops on the line, and I try to write that down because I was reporting back to our government things, and I didn't realize all that. And then he says, and we're going to push them to the sea. I said, who are you going to push to the sea? We're going to push all the Israelis to the sea. I said, what do you think the United States will do? The guy was blustering. He said, we'll take them on. That really, just 2 days before the Six-Day War, and they didn't have that effect. By the time of the Six-Day War, I flew out off to Athens. I got out of there as fast as I could.
You and only one other person were on the airplane.
Yeah, we got on.
They came and got you out.
Yeah, we got on. There's a guy that came to get me out of there. He says, we got to go right away. And so I got on this airplane, and I got on. It was the only two people on the plane, myself and some guy from Aden, who was more nervous than I was. He was... dark-complected guy, sweating profusely. And he had a shoehorn with Nefertiti carved on it.
Oh.
And he was hitting his leg. He says, we're not going to make it. We sat in the airport at Alexandria for some time. He was more nervous than I was. And neither of us were really in good shape. But we got on that plane, two people on that plane, and they... went up in the air, and there were planes. The Mediterranean was full of ships, and we were looking down on that, and we flew and we landed at Athens, and then there was, shortly after that, the king was deposed, King Constantine. I go from one insecure spot to another.
But you were at major spots during major events in 20th century history.
Absolutely. I've been to revolutions in Bolivia.
Oh, boy. I don't know. I'm not going to follow you anyplace.
Pauline, it's been very exciting. I mean, I've had some fantastic times. In Bolivia, the lady tells me I was invited down there to speak. This was after a World Congress in Tokyo. And I was down there in Bolivia, and we visited the ambassador's home in the evening, and the next day they said, there was a little concern there may be disturbance tomorrow. And there was a revolution. And they were marching on the town, coming up from the south. And I didn't like that. And they said, well, don't worry. what we all do is we stay here in this hall, right in the center of town in La Paz. We stay right here. Don't worry about it. We'll hear the revolution, and we just turn the radio on. And all of a sudden, someone says, they won the revolution, and then you say, we all go out and shout, Viva la Victor.
Whoever
won,
didn't matter. They would support
the decision. Who wins is the guy who gets the radio station.
Ah, yes.
The guy who gets to the radio station first and can get up and speak. And we say "Viva!" And then I don't know anything about the language or anything, but I was perfectly willing to be a coward.
You were perfectly willing to say "Viva the victory," the victor, whoever the victor is.
Yeah, whoever the victor is, right?
Well, tell me. Your life seems to have been filled with high points. What about low points?
The death of my parents. That was one of the lowest points there is for me.
When did that occur? And
my father was 81. My mother was 96 when she died. But that was a low point for me.
Now, I know that
the birth of my children was a high point.
Yeah, oh, of course. And now I know
our children
your mother is sort of memorialized in the tree you brought to the garden alongside the radiology building. Tell me about that garden. What made you build it, and why was it so important to you?
I always liked a garden by my office, and I built that garden because I enjoy a garden, and I really loved a garden, and I always wanted to have a garden, and we built it because I really did enjoy it. The tree for my mother, well, it's a patient garden, patient-centered garden. I figured it would help to heal people. And the one thing about it, when we would talk to people, children with cancer or something, and we would be very, very sad thing. And there's nothing more healing than sitting in the ambiance at a Green River garden and the refreshing that it can give you. And I think that's therapeutic. And so we called it the Healing Garden.
And
I had one right by my office when we first went over there. And I've had it, I've expanded it, and now we finally got Fred Poston to agree to let us, we had to pay for everything ourselves, but we built a greenhouse there, and we now grow a number of unusual plants. We have superb horticulturalists, and I've enjoyed that immensely, but so do a lot of other people.
I'm one of them.
It's become a very popular center for campus.
Right. Tell me about the tree that you had planted.
The tree was out in the tree farm here.
Oh.
And it gotten too big to where they wanted to put it. They were going to put it in the horticulture garden, but they didn't get any money to build the horticulture garden in time before the tree got too big to move.
Oh.
And I figured we probably could still move it. I had spent some time in forestry, and I knew about moving trees, and we figured we could move that tree, but it would be a big job. It was a very big job. 57 tons a tree or something like that. When we finally got to moving it with a dirt ball, we cut it down 23 feet in diameter, 6 feet down when it froze solid. We let it freeze solid. It had to be frozen dirt. And this tree was dormant at the time, and the tree was just under general anesthesia. That's my view of it. And it was surgically excised and removed under general anesthesia. Was picked up and moved there from out in the tree farm. It was a very, very big thing. It was a lot of people came from all over the Midwest to see the moving of that big a tree, and that big a deciduous tree, and it was a copper beech.
Yes.
And it is a beautiful tree.
And it's a memory of your mother.
It's a memory of my mother, yes. We dedicated part of the horticultural garden here to my father.
I didn't realize that.
And we dedicated the collection of European literature to the library to my father, and we collected European history. We dedicated the other things to my father. I forget what it was. Oh, the visiting, a prize in different fields. We have 16 different prizes that we put out there.
Right. tell me, what you continue to play a vital role here at the university.
Well, thank you, Pauline.
I like to think that,
but I doubt it.
Oh, no, that's very true. You're a living legend here, as you know. What are your present and future personal goals here at Michigan State?
I love to leave this place off at least as well as I found it. And I'd love to do whatever I can do to increase the quality of whatever we do at Michigan State at every level, from athletics to academics.
And I
try to identify things that other people don't sponsor, like women's basketball.
Right.
I identify things that are not considered the highest priority for many people. Mm-hmm. But I want to bring up every bit of the rear with the rest of it. And I'm trying to move the whole thing along as best we can.
Do you feel good about what has happened so far in your goal to do that?
Pretty good. I haven't done what I wanted to do yet.
Well, there's time.
Yeah, I'm still working at it.
You're still working at it. What do you see as the role of higher education in America today?
Oh, boy. The increasing human capital and in competition with the rest of the world. I don't believe competition is necessary, but people do compete, and I would like to see us increase the overall value of our human capital. And you do that primarily through education. And so I would love to see an enriched education foundation for every area, from literature to music. And I don't know that we're doing that as well as we should.
Well, I don't know if you heard a report that was just out today about our standing in elementary and high school in a worldwide evaluation. We are much lower than all the other advanced countries.
I fully appreciate that because I have spent a lot of time in most of the advanced countries, and I have find that we do not have the discipline at all levels for academic pursuits at all levels, and we have made it pretty easy in many ways without really holding ourselves, our feet to the fire to do that. So I've pushed as hard as I can in every way I can. And it's sometimes considered by many people to be offensive.
Well, any time you push anyone, they're offended. of course. What do you think about the whole new technological approach to higher education?
I think technology has tremendous assistance, and we should use it every way we can. However, we should not abandon the human business of teaching human beings what it is to be human. I mean, we can't jump to technology without having and leave aside everything that is basically human in our culture.
Now, do you think that can be done through the internet learning?
That's one way.
Mm-hmm.
Internet learning is a good thing, and I'm not opposed to that at all. I'd like to see enriched learning capacities at every turn. I don't think there's an area that we don't have to do better in.
Good. Now, would you like to see any changes at Michigan State that might enable it to better fulfill the role that you envision for higher education?
Oh, that's a super question. You know, it's a very sensitive question.
That's right, but I want you to be desensitized.
I'm not comfortable. And I served on the most we can do as faculty is all the faculty committees. So I've been head of the faculty steering committee and a lot of things. I've been very actively, in fact, in academic governance. I served as chairman of the library committee. I've served as a lot of things on campus. But I'm not sure I've always got the ear of the administration. it's frequently easier for me to reach the board than it is the administration. The administration has ways they think they have to get things done, and I'm not sure there's only one way to get anything done. And you have to have your mind open to alternatives. If you think you know the way to go, you ought to be able to learn from others some of the possible alternatives. I hope I said that carefully.
You were very diplomatic. What are your personal plans for the future?
I plan to retire.
Mm-hmm.
When I retire, we're going to cruise a little bit. We're going to take the world cruise on the Crystal Serenity. We're going to go around the world. We've done it before, and we're going to do it again.
Oh, my.
It's a 108-day cruise, and we're gonna. That's one of the personal plans that I'm looking forward to. I love spending time with Jerry, and we're going to do that first. And after that, then I'll probably write some more. I'll write some more books. I used to write books when I was younger. I haven't done that for a couple of years, 5 or 6 years since I've written any book. And I want to write a book, and they would like me to write a book on a history of medical education at Michigan State, which I probably should do.
I think you should.
Yeah.
That sounds great. Now, is there anything else, anything that you would like to discuss?
Pauline, you've been a wonderful friend, and it's good to get to know you even more, okay? At any chance, and I really like people.
Oh, well, that's evident.
And I think that all you have to do in life is pay enough attention to other people. Now, I've not done that as well as I'd like to.
Well, because you've been too busy.
Well, but you never should be too busy to pay attention to other people. And I've done that, and it's something that I'm not proud of. And I would like to really spend more time with people, talking, thinking, learning with them. You can't learn it by yourself. You always need a reinforcement of other people to work together. And I'd like to work more closely with the administration. I'd like to be able to get to know some of their values better than I do. And often I don't do that well. Right now it's not as...
How can you facilitate that kind of interplay with people in the administration?
I don't know. I've tried, and I'm not successful as I'd like to be. Mm-hmm. But I will continue to try.
Good, good. Now, do you have any idea who will succeed you as chair?
Yes. They've already picked, the search committee's picked my successor.
Oh.
And she does not want to meet with me. Well, the reason is I think that I have, she wants to be totally autonomous, which is perfectly reasonable. And I accept that as a...
And that's interesting. Is she someone from inside or outside?
Outside.
Outside.
She's actually been trained by... I trained an individual, and he went off to the University of Washington, and his student, she is his student.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a really good guy, but there's some strong feelings that I don't understand. He's favorably disposed to me. He's written me some nice letters.
Well, because, you know, you're...
I'm controversial.
Well, anyone who's worth anything, I think, is controversial.
Yeah.
But your shoes will be so hard to fill.
She'll probably be able to do it.
And she has to distinguish herself
absolutely
from you. And
I respect that.
And that's hard.
Yeah,
it's very
I respect
hard.
That. It's going to be very hard to do.
Yes.
And it's around here, it's challenging.
It is.
But she's getting a nice building and a very nice facility, a beautiful office.
Right, right.
She might be in Grand Rapids.
She might be in Grand Rapids, that's true. She might not even be here. The department may be in
Grand
Rapids.
Oh, really?
I don't know that.
I see.
I'm not privy to any of what's going on.
Now, who makes these decisions?
The president.
The president, I see. Okay. Oh, so she might be in Grand Rapids. Because I remember years ago when there was first talk of establishing a branch at Grand Rapids of our medical school here. And we were at a party. And I remember overhearing you saying to someone in a group, well, some of the medical school may move to Grand Rapids, but radiology is staying here.
Because we have the physical capital investment here.
Exactly.
We've got almost $30 million worth of equipment here.
And wow.
It cannot be moved. And that was earned money. We didn't get the university, didn't come from the university initially.
No.
But now it's going to go to my successor, and it's going to be up to them to decide what to do with it.
I see. Okay. Anything else you'd like to talk about?
I'd like to talk about anything you want to talk about, Pauline.
I think I've explored. You notice I've stayed away from your personal life. We're just exploring your professional life.
Right.
And on balance, what would be your assessment of Michigan State?
It's a wonderful place to live a life. And that I've done. And I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud of it. I came here, and I think I added value, as have many others. I find it to be a wonderful place for what I wanted out of life. The opportunity to serve, and there still is plenty of that opportunity here. I didn't exhaust the opportunity at all.
Well, no, and I was going to ask you what you saw as the role of retired faculty and what they can play here at the university or in society at large.
Yeah.
Or is retirement just a time to sit back and watch the world drama unfold?
Actually, I have not thought about that because I had never intended to retire. And I don't know what retirement is, so I haven't given it the type of thought that I would need to be able to answer that question meaningfully. What I'm going to do is whatever I can to serve. I hope to be able to continue. I hope someone finds some utility for the things I can do. I think there is things I can do and things that people can find useful.
So you're open.
Yes.
You're open to
absolutely wide open.
To suggestions.
Yeah.
Well, that's encouraging, and I think I hope the right people will hear your statement. And unless you have anything else to say, I want to thank you so much for coming for this interview.
I want to thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.